Yes, hello. Yes, I don't have a PowerPoint. Since it's a book workshop, I thought we would be sitting around a table, and so I didn't prepare a PowerPoint. Exactly. So, first thing, by the way, I just have to make two small points. There was a reference to an article I wrote in 2000 on venue shopping, and I just want to say externalization. The EU-Turkey joint statement setting up French asylum processing centers in Agadez is not a venue. A venue is an institutional framework, a place where you elaborate policies. So that's, you know, Agadez is not a venue. Externalization, if you will, is a policy instrument, and it takes different forms, right? It can be, you know, it can push back the border through diplomatic words, but I just want to make that clear because I think that it sort of mixes two things, the fact that you have policy competence at the EU level, and then within this framework, what kind of policy instruments, such as visas, et cetera, do you set up? The second point is, you mentioned in your talk there was no competence on legal migration. There is, of course. The question is there's no incentive to cooperate on that issue, and I'll get back to that in my, you know, in my commentary. Je ne bouge pas. Je ne touche pas rien. C'est bon? Je suis trop loin maintenant. Non, c'était très bien. Bon. Yeah, but I was uncomfortable. That's the idea. So in my commentary, I want to start by saying that the EU is a complicated issue, right? Because we say it's the EU is like Korea, is like Japan, is like Germany. Well, it's not really a single case. And already we know that, you know, even if we think in a very old kind of methodological nationalism and we think there are bunker states, you know, it's hard to think that, you know, you would just apply the same kind of idea of, you know, a single policy goal, you know, with a sort of aggregate state with a single types of interest vis-a-vis migration, able to develop these policy goals, and then we would just try to observe whether the instruments or the policy outputs fit the kind of goals that were set up. Or so, you know, the whole discussion on the gap hypothesis in the EU is even more complicated because, you know, you not only do you have 28 member states, actually more or less, sometimes you don't have the UK and Ireland, but you have Norway and Switzerland. You have, you know, a whole set of actors. So I just want to mention that also to say that the chapter is impressive in trying to make accessible this very complicated jargon-like setup, which is the European Union. Just 2 points before I go to a sort of Gary Freeman slash Christian Jobke version of what I think about the dynamics behind EU policy at the moment. One point is one of the main arguments that that's in the paper is to say top level convergence will not happen and is not happening, so there will be cooperation among like-minded states. Now, when I read that, I think top level convergence was never supposed to have happened. And if you think about the history, we now have more than 30 years, almost 40 years of history of cooperation, which concerns international mobility and immigration. It was five countries, Benelux, France, and Germany, in a small, beautiful, you know, on a beautiful boat by some loving white wine, with some lovely white wine. And the idea was to have a small group, like a club, of people who trusted one another, who would, you know, be able to be then, you know, to do it maybe horizontal convergence, meaning people could join the club if the original five agreed. So think of all the efforts, Spain that was discussed earlier, the effort Spain made to join Schengen to show that it was dealing with its southern sea borders, for instance. So the idea of top-level convergence should never have happened. And believe me, the people who were in charge of Justice and Home Affairs, which is now called something else at the time, were very angry at the Amsterdam Treaty to see their Schengen baby be incorporated into EU law. So the fact that you say now it's, you know, maybe what we'll see is small groups of like-minded states, that's the way it should have been. There was some naivete, of course, I think, on the parts of old member states during the accession period. I think a sort of paternalistic idea that if you gave enough money to the Poles and the Hungarians and the others to beef up their borders, they would not complain, they would not become autonomous agents after that. But so that's to this notion. You have to think that the dynamics of convergence is mostly horizontal, or even as we say in French, tâche d'huile, like you, you know, you go from one, you sort of expand slowly those who are to be trusted. Clearly the Greeks are not to be trusted, so you have to have hotspots and have people imported from EU agencies and others. The second point, main point in the paper is a point about politicization, which is of course a very vague term, and I think you made a very great effort in the presentation to define exactly what you meant by that, which is both salience and polarization. And I think that's one thing that we really have to think about. I've been writing a lot, and actually with a published recently a blog post on this, because I think we have to differentiate public opinion and polarization public opinion, which we can observe, and it's within country polarization as much as, you know, differences between, let's say, the north and the south and east and the west. And indeed, polarization by political parties that try to exploit the... So it wasn't clear. I think that's something that needs to be clarified in the paper, since in Andrew Geddes' paper with his colleague Denison, I think, they do make the case that there's not, people are not more racist now, or so it's really more the question of political leaders trying to make the case of that. So now I come to the trilemma, and how I interpret how EU policies, the state of EU immigration and asylum and borders policy is going, although I won't talk about asylum because Aiko's sitting next to me and he's written like for the last 20 years about this. So remember Freeman plus Jobke, that means that you have to worry about three things. Immigration, people don't have to be racist or even think that the issue is salient. Usually you think that people could be threatened are pretty skeptical about immigration. So there is incentive indeed to have policy making behind gilded doors. But second point, you have of course a number of economic interest groups, or it could be also migrant groups themselves, which doesn't work so well in Europe, but at least, and you know, we know the sectors, agriculture, building, care sector, etc. We're quite happy to have immigration. So that's Freeman, right? The third element, which Christian Jobke wrote about, and I also wrote about a long time ago, including in a book we co-edited called Controlling a New Migration World, is the tension between law and politics, right? So the self, what Christian calls the sort of self-restricted sovereignty in the post-war era in Europe, where you do have constitutions and national constitutions and European conventions, etc., that restrict restrict state discretion vis-à-vis immigrants. So where does the EU fit in here? Number one, the question of interest groups. One reason that we do not have so much stuff on legal immigration, we have, you know, a meek little blue card directive that was adopted. We have, you know, vague directives about long-term residence, etc. Is that there's no incentive to cooperate. You want to attract the biggest talent in your country. Why would you, if the blue card was supposed to be the European green card, right? This is still about national competition. Every global city in every member state wants to be the one that attracts, the people leaving London after Brexit, or, you know, the Indian high-tech workers, right? So there's no real incentive to cooperate. So that fits in very well with Freeman's view. There's no reason why there should be cooperation in that sense, because it's, and it's indeed very much not discussed. The second aspect, though, is the public, you know, showing that displaying control, this obsession that governments have to show, not that they accept or not migration, but at least that they're able to open and close the door. Okay, so that's what I'm, you know, really showing control. And here, I think that's one of the limits also of EU cooperation. When you want to do that, again, you do that as a national government. You do like, you know, Trump's trying to build his wall, but of course we've had a lot of walls built in Europe as well. Orban is going to build a wall precisely by saying, I'm not going to wait for these Brussels bureaucrats, blah, 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 I'm going to build my wall. When France closes the Schengen border, it's the same thing. So in these moments of salience, it's true that it's going to be everybody, you know, there's no incentive for cooperation. So the real incentive, which is really this question of saying, it's in the case of trying to indeed have illiberal policies, if you will, or not to respect asylum, or not to respect fundamental rights, due process, rule of law, sometimes now basic access to, you know, to rights. It's not to give act, you know, to be able to not respect that. Then that's where you have most of the policies that were developed at EU level and that are still now being developed through externalization. But the very basic ideas, the Schengen visa, the carrier sanctions that were adopted, but, you know, very early on, were already about not having people arrive, not having asylum seekers arrive. So we have now a picture, if you will, of, yes, we shouldn't be expecting cooperation on legal migration, because I think, especially if it's not just highly skilled, you also have, by the way, a market of 500 million people in Europe still moving around. You don't really have, and I think the EU is not going to be doing so well. Even Frontex, I think people don't know exactly what Frontex is doing if you ask someone in an opinion poll. But if, you know, their president bangs on the table and you know, and says, we will, one of the president or the vice president of the council says, you know, we will prevent all NGO boats from rescuing people, we will close the Italian border, you know, they will definitely hear about that. So this area of EU cooperation, really, what we can study is all these policies relating to pushing back the border and diplomatic, so, and also diplomatic cooperation with transit and sending countries. A lot of efforts there. Is it successful? Well, of course, you can count the number of deaths, which is more than 2,000 last year, right? But is it even successful? Are people not leaving? Is that how we would sort of see if there's a gap? I wouldn't even answer that question. I think there's, because I think what counts is to study the actors involved in these very EU, of course, law and I mean, border guard agencies, but also the private companies who are selling a lot of technology for security, all sorts of people who basically now have an incentive to pursue remote control policies. And I'll stop here.
Let me also say thank you for sticking with us here until the bitter end. And
it's too hot to go outside anyway.
It's been a fantastic couple of days. So I can only repeat what others have said already. So I'm going to also comment on this EU chapter. Mm-hmm. Let me maybe just start with the idea that I agree with a lot of the key kind of messages that are coming out of the chapter. The chapter is extremely well done. I was inspired by some of the pictures that Phil and others had put up. So I have here a picture of the EU's external border at a particular point, the enclave of Melilla. I guess it demonstrates some of the challenges that the EU faces when it comes to external. Yes, it could be that too. Yes. I have no idea what the ownership is, right? So I think the chapter does a great job addressing some of the key challenges that the EU faces. It does an excellent job in highlighting the role of regional governance in the immigration management in Europe, which is often a missing component in the comparative treatment of immigration policy in various volumes. So I think this is credit to the editors that you are talking about the EU as well. The focus of the paper, of course, is on the regulation of third country nationals, non-EU citizens, right? Irregular migrants, asylum seekers, as you said. I guess there is a question to be asked whether we should focus more on intra-EU migration, in free movement of EU citizens, right? Of course, as we heard from others in earlier sessions, I think, François, you mentioned this, right? Obviously, these are significant numbers, right, in terms of intra-EU migration. Of course, intra-EU migration is important to understand Brexit, so some of the big debates in Europe at the moment that have clear links with migration. And it's also important as, of course, it is a pretty unique case of regional governance, this free movement regime, which is virtually an open border regime, which obviously links with, I guess, some wider debates in the literature, right? Of course, one can ask the question how to treat free movement. Should we treat it as the migration of immigrants in the traditional sense, or as the internal mobility of EU citizens, and hence kind of slightly different to our traditional notions of immigration? But that's maybe something for the authors and the editors to think about. So, just very briefly on the key contributions of the chapter that I mostly agree with completely, right? This idea that we have seen a challenge in recent years, a politicization of the EU level that have posed, I guess, a challenge to this traditional venue shopping logic that you, Virginie, have wrote about so eloquently many years ago. So clearly, there are also challenges that the EU has faced as a result, and a lot of things that people have criticized with regard to EU policymaking in recent years obviously have related to the concerns about EU developing more restrictive, lowest common denominator policies, about implementation deficits, about failure to achieve equitable burden sharing, and so on. So I'll come back to some of these notions in a moment. I completely agree that obviously some of these challenges can be said to have led to a greater search for, I guess, other venues. I agree with your point, though, and I might change that they might not be venues as such, but new mechanisms of externalizing, I guess, what has traditionally been EU-based policy making. Of course, with regard to the impact of externalization, I completely agree also that I think a lot of this has been rather negative, right? Negative for countries outside the EU, right? If you look at, I guess, the distribution of responsibilities, we look at countries like Turkey that we heard earlier on, but also look at countries like Jordan and Lebanon, right? Of course, Lebanon, a country of 4.5 million people, hosting over a million Syrians, right? I think that puts, obviously, the EU debate into perspective. And, of course, it also tells us a lot about this idea that David Fitzgerald so eloquently develops in his new book, about the absence of safe entry routes for legitimate asylum seekers and refugees into the European Union, or what Sandor Lavanek called organized hypocrisy when it comes to humanitarian policy in the EU and other OECD countries. My main argument, though, this afternoon will be that much of the literature on the role of the European Union in migration management, in particular asylum and refugee management, has perhaps been overly critical and overly pessimistic. And let me try and make a few remarks in that regard. All right, so I will look in particular, as I said, on three things that the EU has been quite significantly involved in, and that's the development of rights, common standards at the EU level, obviously implementation of and the oversight of implementation of these standards, and then attempts to responsibility share or burden share, as some people have called it. Right, let me just say a few words about the conceptualization of this and putting it into, I guess, the framework of the liberal constraint ideas. Right, there have been earlier mentions in the discussions over the past 2 days to the contributions of Saskia Bonjour, Natasha Zaun, my new colleague at LSE. And of course, Natasha and I, we recently published in the European Common, Journal of Common Market Studies, our piece on escaping populism, where we've tried to, I guess, more systematically provide a conceptual basis of why one might expect rights-enhancing or rights-protecting tendencies through European cooperation, something that goes against some of the existing, or quite a lot of the existing literature on EU asylum policies. So let me just run briefly through these three dimensions: rights, implementation, and burden sharing. Right. So I think with regard to the concern about rights, I think we have to remind ourselves, and this is perhaps something that I slightly disagree with in terms of the paper. The paper says that really the key aim of EU policy has been about stemming the flows of irregular migrants and asylum seekers. And I think really, for me, European policymaking has been primarily about to dealing with the redistributive implications of collective action problems that the creation of the single market has created. And so really, a lot of what the EU has done over the past 2 decades or so is trying to set common minimum standards that would limit or prevent free-riding opportunities of individual member states within that common European asylum system that the EU has tried to develop. So what we've really tried to do is to limit individual member states' ability to engage in regulatory competition, to make themselves more restrictive than their neighbors, and basically shifting burdens onto neighboring member states, right? We have also seen very little evidence of this cooperation leading to lowest common denominator standards, as Natasha Zaun has argued. And instead, what we have seen is actually a number of member states, both in the south and the north of Europe, both in east and west, having faced adaptation pressures where national regulations had to be adapted to higher EU standards that have been established at the EU level. So I think that's something to celebrate, and we can discuss in a moment how far these changes have gone. Implementation, just very, very briefly, right? Is it just of course true that implementation is not just challenged at the EU level? Arguably, the EU's track record is not necessarily so much worse than in other parts. You might remember the famous study by Georgetown Law School a few years ago called Refugee Roulette, which looked at huge implementation variation within the US when it comes to the treatment of asylum seekers, and huge variation in recognition rates, right, between states, between courts, between judges, and so on. And of course, what the EU has developed, and maybe that's where I slightly disagree with Virginie also, obviously there is some kind of vertical system of oversight when it comes to the implementation of EU rules, right? So we have the Commission as the implementation watchdog, we have the ECJ, which is supposed to sanction member states if they don't do what their job is to be as a member state in terms of complying with EU law, and so from that perspective, I think we have had some vertical convergence that has been going on. A classic case of this is, of course, when we look at recognition rates. In the early years of European integration and in the early years of the common EU asylum system, right, this goes back to Giuseppe's point earlier on, right, that we should compare groups within countries when we look at recognition rates, and that's exactly what I'm doing here, right? And you see huge variation for the same groups of individuals arriving at the same time, right? For countries that are operating supposedly under a common European policy. And of course, Greece stands out, right, as really the one with the lowest recognition rates, right? But then remember what happened. A few years later, Greece was dragged in front of the European Court of Justice, the so-called NS case, dealing with an Afghani asylum seeker, and was really criticized very harshly for not complying with EU and international legal obligations. And if you look at the recognition rates in Greece since the court judgment that came out in around 2009, you see a significant convergence trend for a number, I've just had the Afghan example here, but for a number of groups of asylum seekers, basically Greek recognition rates are converging towards the EU average, right? And I think that's a direct example of the influence of a supranational court like the ECJ. I think in a way, one could be more optimistic and say, right, well, this is a relatively new regime, right? Implementation problems will exist, and they do exist in the national context, but we see some positive convergence trends as a result of vertical compliance mechanisms. Right, and that brings me then to burden sharing. I probably have written too much about responsibility and burden sharing in my life. A lot of people obviously have stressed that some of the key concerns here in this area for the EU has been to try and limit free riding through common policies, as I argued. There have been some attempts to, I guess, compensate the most affected states in the European Union through a common EU budget. And some of these instruments were also mentioned earlier on. And of course, then there have been these initiatives to share individual asylum seekers and refugees across member states. Obviously, the most notable initiative was the 2015 quota-based relocation initiative. And of course, that initiative rightly has been criticized significantly because of its lack of implementation, which was poor. But I think it set, in my opinion, an important precedent. For the first time, we really moved beyond the idea that in Europe, when it comes to redistributive policies, we only do voluntary redistribution. For the first time, we have set a precedent now where we have created a framework for legally binding non-voluntary redistribution. All right, so that brings me then to the end. If you're interested in that redistribution argument, I've got a paper in the Journal of Common Market Studies that just came out that is elaborating on that idea. So let me just sum up then, right? So I would argue that there are a number of positive effects that European cooperation has created. I guess there is a question about the significance of these changes that the EU has introduced, right? And this goes back to this idea of, that the paper talks about, namely that the policy core has remained unchanged, right? And of course, the question is really, what our expectation about a realistic change introduced from the European Union is, right? From that perspective, if you think about that, EU policies have created or guaranteed the right to work for asylum seekers. It has created policies on subsidiary protection, which didn't exist in many member states. It has guaranteed independent judicial reviews for asylum seekers that didn't exist in countries like Greece beforehand. It ended detention without time limits and so on. I think these are significant changes, and I would say they are probably changes to some kind of realistic expectations about what changes to a policy core might involve. So in that sense, I would argue that maybe the EU argues less from a gap between a restrictive rhetoric and liberal outcomes, but more from unrealistic expectations. My former colleague at LSE, Christopher Hill, coined the term of the capability expectation gap when talking about EU foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And it, to me, it seems that this idea seems relevant in the EU migration policy context too. So it's clear for me that the EU has limitations and shortcomings, but we should be careful what we wish for when we might be tempted to look at EU shortcomings and call for a move towards greater renationalization of competences in EU asylum and immigration policies. Thank you.
Well.
Okay. Hello again, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to make comments on the EU as well. And first of all, thank you, Leila, so much for such an interesting and very insightful presentation. I have learned a lot in a very good sense. And as Virgin, if I may, and Aiko has also made an excellent comment on your paper, I will limit myself only to the very brief points, two points, but general but very brief one. And the first one is on the burden sharing. And I must confess that I am also inspired by a lot of your work. And, you know, my comments from now on is based on, I mean, a kind of reflection of what you're writing, especially the last year's JCMS article. Okay, and the second one is on EU competence in the global governance. The first one, the burden responsibility sharing, as many have already cited, the CERC finds in its paper for the Journal of Refugee Studies in 1998, the role of a hegemon in the creation of an international regime of refugee protection just after the World War II. And as you all may know, the prevention of Jewish and later the Vietnamese migrants from the repatriation to the communist bloc is equivalent to the US activity to maximize its national interest against its adversary. And refugee protection was more directly linked with the national security. In addition, this was the exact cause for the US to become a provider of global or international public goods. And the transaction costs were mainly considered as costs to confront the communist alliance. So in contrast to that, the contemporary global environment poses the question of whether or not an international regime is possible without a hegemon. Or in other words, how convincingly we understand refugee protection to be the international public goods. The refugee protection regime, if any, is not able to be explained by neoliberalism by itself because it is very unlikely to become a coordination game in the regime formation. It is very unlikely to be the case that states will have a relative gain by collaboration or confidence building because accepting refugees do not automatically lead to an increase of national interest, to my regret. Mm-hmm. And if we say that, then how about the neo-realism? And again, I would say the negative point in that. The repetition of zero-sum game analogy wouldn't explain it either. The tit-for-tat strategy wouldn't work because it is costly, not only physically, but also the possibility, there is a possibility that the countries trading refugees and asylum seekers will lose international reputation, as you write, due to their negligence in human rights. And more essentially, it is uncertain that the deflection of a country in the first game could endanger its national security. We would never know. So the problem that lies with regards to burden or responsibility sharing of refugee is not that of cooperation, but rather that of commitment, I would think. The international migration, migrants and refugees in particular, are of global concern for sure, but I'm quite pessimistic to the view of their protection as international public goods. Mm-hmm. And the reason is there are still so many countries that regard national security by not accepting them. So countries neighboring to each other in particular must share the perception of instability by the overflow of asylum seekers for sure, but the shared perception will not necessarily lead to the burden sharing with each other, as long as there are other third countries in the world that automatically end up accepting the migrants, even if reluctantly. Mm-hmm. So on this point, I quite agree with Aiko's idea, claiming that the Dublin system works more as a mechanism of burden shifting rather than burden sharing. And we could even go further to argue that the prevalence of a mechanism on the global scale, and it is very crucial to emphasize that the burden shifting is not costly. While diplomatic interaction is required for the stabilized scheme of burden sharing, burden shifting is possible as a result of no commitment. But what's not good for the current European Union is this preference for burden shifting is also shared by non-EU states. And what the non-EU state is doing actually is a non-commitment to the scheme, exactly with the same logic as the EU member states rely on. So this is a pessimistic view, but what explains the reality in the realm of global governance on migration, where the non-EU countries are not always cooperative to the idea of global governance on migration. And in this realm, I would briefly say a little bit about the EU competency, please. As an outsider, I also see the EU's willingness to commit in the framework setting, and it is very remarkable. And I really evaluate the efforts of the EU, so you really don't have to be so pessimistic about it. It is not entirely seen as a venue shifting, as you mentioned. EU does play a crucial role for the creation of global governance, even unintentionally, and it is clear when we put a counterfactual hypothesis out as well. But having said that, it is indeed important to recognize that the EU power is only perceived as solid when the integrity of the EU is guaranteed. Because, like Virginie said, the EU is not the normal nation state, so it's not able to be perceived as a political actor, per se. So it needs to show the outer world that it has a competency because it is an integrated entity to ensure liberal democracy, the rule of law, and the protection of human rights. And this is what constitutes a normative power Europe argument, as I understand. The problem lies in this regard is that there is yet to be any consensus, particularly on the reception of refugees and asylum seekers in a shared manner inside the European Union. It is true that the European Commission intends to create a closer union by increasing the binding power of EU law, as many have already argued, but such activities are quite risky when you consider the possibility of sabotage by its member states. Often, the refined legal order in the anarchic world could produce a commitment problem. A more relaxed cooperative scheme is therefore ideal in this case, but the recent European crisis on refugees tell us the Commission could act on the contrary. So the EU leadership in the global management of international migration is desperately needed, in particular by the migrants themselves, but history tells us that their protection was a mere accidental result of power politics. It is, however, too miserable to recognize the balance of power or balance of terror as the sole incentive for refugee protection. So the policy linkage approach is thus indispensable, and I expect quite a lot for that. But we certainly need a collective political will to build a solid international cooperative framework for its support. And how and why it is missing must be the questions we would have to follow.
Okay, thank you, Midori. I see a lot of hands already going up. We're going to take a round of questions and then come back to the audience.